Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, or it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, France 24, NHK Japan, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. The Israeli army raided and closed the bureau for news network Al Jazeera in the West Bank following a closing down of their offices in East Jerusalem. Thibaut Bruton, the general director of Reporters Without Borders, discusses the importance of the only network supplying footage from Palestine without being embedded in the Israeli army. Then Mirav Zonzin from the International Crisis Group talks about Netanyahu's rejection of a ceasefire in the wars on Palestine and Lebanon. She also describes the probable outcome of an Israeli ground attack on Lebanon. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
The Israeli army has raided and closed the bureau of media network Al Jazeera in the occupied West Bank. The Qatari broadcaster aired footage of heavily armed and masked troops entering their premises in Ramallah. Israel has ordered a 45-day shutdown. 4 months ago, Israel closed the channel's offices in East Jerusalem. The board of the Foreign Press Association in Israel and the Palestinian territories has condemned the raid, saying it signals a shift away from democratic values. And for more on this, let's bring in the General Director of Reporters Without Borders, Thibaut Bruton. He joins us now from New York City. Thibaut, the Israeli military alleges that the Al Jazeera newsroom is being used to, quote, incite terror, to support terrorist activities, and that the channel's broadcasts endanger security and public order. What's your take on this?
Oh, it's a preposterous statement, but it's unfortunately in line with the past statements from the Israeli Defense Forces regarding journalism. In general, and you mentioned some of the comments that have been made by the media community about the position of Israel towards Al Jazeera, we're facing a kind of specific persecution of Al Jazeera in order to deprive this media outlet from continuing its activities wherever, actually in Gaza, in Jerusalem, and now in the West Bank.
What's behind that?
I think what we have to question is the will of the Israeli authorities to have specific laws and specific regulations targeting this channel. This channel is one of the most seen within the region, and it has an impact. It is a channel that is well known for its reports, which are numerous, accurate, and are in line with international standards of journalism. So trying to depict Al Jazeera as a propaganda outlet, as a terrorism group, is a technique in order to silence a journalism worthy of that name.
Now, how does the closure of Al Jazeera's office in Ramallah affect press freedom in the Palestinian territories, you think?
So Al Jazeera plays a very specific role in the sense that it's a channel and actually a series of channels which are well regarded within the media community and are able to pick up some stories which could otherwise remain at national or local level. So it's really not only the ears and eyes of some of the things that happen on the ground, it's also a way to spread information at the international level. That's precisely why the Qatar has invested so much money into these channels. So I think what we need to be careful of is that if channels that are reporting on Gaza in on the West Bank are not able to continue their work, we will be entering a kind of dangerous zone where there is no free reporting apart from the people that are either propagandists from some of the terrorist groups or embedded within the Israeli Defense Forces. So it's a game nobody wants to play, because at the end of the day, what we will be deprived of is the right to know what's happening as an international community.
The General Director of the Reporters Without Borders organization, Thibault Boutin, thank you very much.
Calls are growing for a ceasefire across the Israel-Lebanon border to halt the missile attacks that have claimed more than 600 lives in 3 days. The proposal was put forward by the United States and France and has been endorsed by countries including Germany. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has yet to respond, instead ordering the army to continue fighting with full force. Let's speak now to Mirav Sunshine, who is a senior analyst at the International Crisis Group, an independent organization working to prevent wars. She joins us from Tel Aviv. It's great to have you on DW News. So international leaders are pressing hard for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. Netanyahu has told soldiers to keep fighting. Is the current ceasefire proposal essentially dead in the water?
It certainly seems that way. I mean, we've been at this war for 11 months now. We're almost at a year. And it's very, very important that there be pressure for a ceasefire, both in Gaza and in Lebanon. So I'm happy to see that leaders are working hard and trying, but there has to be more done. And right now, it seems like what's happening is they're putting it out there, the American and the French, and they're seeing what Israel and Lebanon, or Hezbollah more correctly, are doing in response. And right now, both, or at least the Israeli side, has outright rejected it. And there's political consensus across Israel that there can't be a ceasefire right now. So it does seem dead even before it has had a chance to gain any traction.
Is Israel not listening to its biggest ally, the United States, anymore?
In some ways, Israel hasn't been listening to the U.S., not just its ally, but its funder and provider of military weapons and diplomatic cover. But I think the more important thing to think about here is that the U.S. has not used its leverage. It hasn't used its power. The Biden administration has clearly made a decision not to use his power to not supply Israel with certain weapons with which it is prosecuting wars in both Gaza and Lebanon. And without pushing Netanyahu in that way, we'll never know if that leverage could actually work to de-escalate or to reach actual ceasefire. So I would say it's less about Israel listening and more about the U.S. not pushing.
Right. Now, Israeli soldiers have also been told to prepare for a possible ground offensive in Lebanon. Could a ground offensive achieve Israel's stated goal of improving security for Israelis?
Based on our experience in 2006 and what's known as the Second Lebanon War, absolutely not. That war was one of the first wars where Israel clearly did not win, and it had a ground invasion. It lasted, I think, 30-some days. There is the constant threat of a ground invasion in some circles in Israel in the far right. It's a fait accompli. The displaced residents have been calling for it. Their fears are very, very real. They don't want anybody that they can see from their houses, any Radwan forces, any Hezbollah weapons there. But a ground invasion will be a net loss for Israel. It's something that I don't think will achieve even basic security for the north, not to mention the entire country being under rocket fire, something that a ground invasion cannot do. And very similar to the goals that we've seen in Gaza. You know, if Israel has not been able to remove the threat of Hamas, or at least detach Hamas from its stronghold in Gaza, then I don't see how it can do it with Hezbollah, which is much, much stronger, has a huge backing in Iran as its patron. I just don't see it happening.
You've mentioned Gaza there. Of course, this whole situation that we're talking about is going on as the war in Gaza continues. Do you see an end to the situation there?
Unfortunately, I don't. We're a year in and there's no end in sight. There's no exit strategy. There's no day after plan. And I think Israel's trying now to decouple the fronts. It's trying to get Hezbollah to back down from its commitment to keep firing unless there's a ceasefire in Gaza. And Netanyahu has made clear that he's not interested in a ceasefire. And Israel's own defense officials have gotten behind the hostage deal and ceasefire that Netanyahu continues to reject. So unfortunately, I see it right now indefinite IDF presence in Gaza, and as well as a continuation of the escalation we're seeing in Lebanon, really with no exit strategy or off-ramp.
Now, militants in neighboring countries have started to attack Israel too. There were reports that the southern city of Eilat was supposedly hit by drones from the Iraqi Islamic Resistance. How do you interpret all of this?
Well, there's been, you know, proxies from Iraq, from Syria and other places, Yemen, the Houthis, of course, they've been firing at Israel since the October 7th Hamas attack. So that's been part of the reality here. Yemen and Iraq are obviously much farther away from Israel, so it's a different kind of animal than Hezbollah. What we can understand from this is that if this continues and if Israel ups the escalation ladder, that they will also probably up the escalation on their side and try to fire more and more at Israel and maybe also at American targets. And what we face for, again, the last 11 months, but even more so now, is the threat of all-out regional war that would pull in Iran, that would pull in the U.S., even though nobody really wants that, in lieu of any kind of diplomacy and in lieu of pressure on Israel, that's where we're headed.
We'll leave it there. Mirav Sunshine from the International Crisis Group in Tel Aviv. Thanks for joining us on DW News today.
Those interviews were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. They're also available at most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. Next, France 24. Press reviews from Tuesday and Wednesday on the war on Lebanon from both Israeli, Lebanese, and the international media. Then a report on what Europeans think about another possible Trump presidency in the United States. France 24.
Now, Dipti's joining us now to look through the papers. Israel strikes against Hezbollah in Lebanon killed almost 500 people yesterday, including, of course, dozens of children. The papers are talking about that, Dipti.
Yeah, that's right. So this is from Al-Aqba, which is a pro-Hezbollah paper. This is the headline on its front page today: "The Monster of Gaza Destroys Lebanon." The paper admitting that Hezbollah fired first against Israel to show its support for Gaza. It adds, Hezbollah didn't react like kids in a neighborhood who wanted to take revenge on a neighbor who insulted us. I quote, "We acted with full consciousness of what we were doing because the essence of resistance and our central objective is the elimination of the occupying force." So that paper there saying that Hezbollah did make the first move and it had very solid reasons for doing so. For the Arab language Lebanese paper Anaha, this is the front page here, the paper referring to the country being in a, quote, dark tunnel or a tunnel of darkness, referring to that bloody and destructive day yesterday that killed nearly 500 people in the country. And this is from L'Orient Le Jour, the French language Lebanese paper, on its front page, evoking the idea that a nightmare has now become a reality. The paper says war was on Lebanon's doorstep for many months, but it was relatively dormant, limited, and appeared far away, up until yesterday at least, when war was unleashed with a fury on Lebanon. And in its analysis, Laurent Nujour's editorial today says, just to what point will this war become complete and total? The paper's editor says, we're no longer talking about minor escalations or low-intensity conflict. This is a full-blown war now, and Hezbollah will not give in and will not stop fighting until a ceasefire is concluded in Gaza.
What about the Israeli press then, Dipti? What are they saying?
Well, varied responses depending on the political line of the Israeli papers. This is from the Jerusalem Post, a pretty hard-line Israeli paper, which in its front page reprises Benjamin Netanyahu's statement yesterday that Israel will not wait for a threat, but will rather preempt any threats to its national sovereignty. In its editorial, the paper's editor says, calls those Israeli strikes on Lebanon long overdue, saying that Israel has finally responded with decisive action against Hezbollah after years of constant provocation. And the paper says it's not just justified, it's long overdue. I quote, "No sovereign nation would stand idle while its citizens are targeted and its security is undermined. Israel is no exception to that." Now, from Haaretz, the center-left paper in Israel, it's a little bit more measured, a bit more moderate in its response. In fact, the paper offers a very sharp rebuke of Israel today, saying it took, quote, "another giant step towards greenlighting state terror. It has used violent means to impose terror and suffering on Gaza, the occupied West Bank, and now Lebanon."
So if we look at this analysis piece in The Guardian view on Israel and Hezbollah, the war is already here. The subtitle says, "De-escalation through escalation is not a strategy, just wishful thinking." Of course, the article touches on the fact that strategy, if it is to push Hezbollah to back down through escalating the attacks, that may not work, partly because the humiliation of Hezbollah through the device attacks will make it harder for them to back down without losing credibility, as well as, on the other side, popular pressure on Prime Minister Netanyahu to be tougher on Hezbollah. Let's have a look at the Washington Post on that note. This article cites some polling from the Israeli Democracy Institute back in August, and it says 67% of Israelis at that time called for a more aggressive approach on Hezbollah, and 47% went so far as to support an assault deep into Lebanon, including targeting infrastructure. So if de-escalation through escalation is the plan, well, certainly there's popular support in Israel for a high level of intensity, and it's not necessarily likely that'll make easy for Hezbollah to back down.
Now, of course, Joe Biden has also continued to call for a de-escalation, but with only months to go before he leaves the White House, his chances of success seem to be disappearing into thin air.
Absolutely, yes. So this article in the New York Times yesterday said that the president is starting to acknowledge that a ceasefire, a hostage exchange deal, is looking less and less likely before he leaves office in just a few months' time. This article also provides reports citing sources in the international security team around the president, reporting shouting matches between Netanyahu and Biden over the phone, and general atmosphere in the White House being that they consider that Netanyahu may have been a bad faith negotiator. And the question, did he keep throwing in new conditions for a ceasefire deal to keep his coalition together or to keep himself in office and out of court? So extremely sceptical in the White House there. Haaretz has this same story, saying America's exasperation with Netanyahu came too late. Extremely damning of the US president, says his handling of Gaza has been yet lax, tentative and often phlegmatic. And the president was warned for months that he was being taken for a ride by Netanyahu. He was confident they could rein him in, and he was wrong, says Haaretz on President Biden.
When Donald Trump announced J.D. Vance as his running mate, it reignited fears about what a second Trump term could mean for Europe. Vance has made his isolationist views clear from the start. Just after Russia launched its full-scale invasion in Ukraine, he said on a podcast, quote, "I gotta be honest with you, I don't really care what happens to Ukraine, one way or another." Trump himself has put ongoing funding for Kyiv in doubt and has vowed he would end the war in 24 hours if he wins, without explaining how. He's also said he would not come to the defense of a NATO ally that was under attack by Russia if that member wasn't paying a sufficient amount on its own defense.
"No, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want. You got to pay."
The U.S. Congress has since passed legislation to limit a president's ability to pull out of NATO. But with the exception of Hungary's Trump-friendly Viktor Orban, EU leaders have spent months increasingly concerned about what a Trump-Vance administration could mean for Europe's overall security.
"If 2024 brings us America first again, it will be more than ever Europe on its own."
When it became clear that Trump would be the Republican candidate in 2024, French President Emmanuel Macron argued that Europe should be more assertive on the world stage and not depend on the U.S. for its own long-term security.
Will the U.S. administration remain the same? No one knows, and we cannot delegate our collective security and our stability to the choice of American voters in the years to come.
When NATO members gathered in Washington in July, they made attempts to make the alliance Trump-proof, agreeing to support Ukraine on an irreversible path to NATO membership, along with a long-term pledge of funding to Kyiv from NATO allies.
Those press reviews and report were from France 24. France 24 may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They are also available at most podcast sites. On to NHK World Radio Japan. Two reports from the gatherings at the United Nations. First, there was a preliminary summit on a proposal called the Pact for the Future, which aims to rebuild trust among nations so as to move forward, and reforms to the makeup of the Security Council. At the opening of the General Assembly, Secretary General Guterres criticized the level of impunity in the world, saying it is intolerable. NHK Japan.
World leaders gathering at the United Nations have adopted new guidelines amid growing global challenges. The document called the Pact for the Future aims to help the international community address future issues. But some countries criticize the pact as having a Western bias. The two-day Summit of the Future conference kicked off on Sunday in New York ahead of an annual debate at the UN General Assembly. Two of the pact's five chapters are titled International Peace and Security and Transforming Global Governance. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for international cooperation. He said he has learned that people never agree on the past, and to rebuild trust, we must start with the present and look to the future. Before the text was adopted, delegates from Russia, North Korea, Iran, and three other countries tried to alter the pact. They introduced an amendment saying it could interfere in another country's affairs. The move was overwhelmingly dismissed. The Pact for the Future also highlights the urgent need to reform the United Nations Security Council, which is said to be dysfunctional due to rivalry among permanent members. The call for reform was echoed by Japanese Prime Minister Kishida Fumio, who said there should be concrete actions to improve the Council as next year marks the UN's 80th anniversary. Kishida made the plea in his address to the UN Summit of the Future.
The great majority of states support the expansion of both permanent and non-permanent membership categories in the UN Security Council. The majority are also acutely aware of its vital role in international peace and security and the need to restore trust.
Kishida concluded by saying world leaders must unite under the banner of multilateralism to build a better future, and that Japan remains unwavering in its commitment to the UN.
Leaders from around the globe have converged on New York for the world's largest diplomatic gathering. But they've arrived at the United Nations General Assembly at a time of division. And they've been told the global state of affairs is unsustainable. The UN Secretary General opened the debate by telling leaders that the level of impunity in the world is intolerable.
Wars rage with no clue how they will end. And nuclear posturing and new weapons cast a dark shadow. We are edging towards the unimaginable, a power keg that risks engulfing the world.
Guterres says some leaders are trampling on the UN Charter and on international law. He referenced the classic board game in saying they feel entitled to a get-out-of-jail-free card. He cited the war in Ukraine and what he called the nonstop nightmare in Gaza. He says that conflict threatens to take the entire region with it. He pointed at Lebanon and the fighting between Israeli forces and Hezbollah militants.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 10 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp and most podcast sites. All the times they announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. If you have questions or comments about the Shortwave Report or could help support this program, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com. Or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show going. Please join them. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Large-scale demonstrations against the wars in the Middle East and their funding were held in major cities around the world last weekend. The Palestinian Minister of Health updated the numbers of medical workers killed and kidnapped in Palestine. Radio Havana, Cuba.
In response to the continued Israeli aggression in Gaza, large-scale demonstrations were held in several cities and capitals around the world on Saturday. Demonstrations in support of the Palestinian people and demanding a truce and humanitarian aid to Gaza took place in cities across Europe, including Paris, Vienna, Uppsala, Stockholm, Milan, Maastricht, Liverpool, Athens, Copenhagen, Helsinki, Hamburg, Freiburg, and Berlin. The demonstrators carried signs condemning the crimes committed by the Israeli occupation against the Palestinian people and waved Palestinian flags. Participants stressed the need to end discrimination and demanded accountability for the occupation's actions, especially for violence against children. The Palestinian Minister of Health, Abu Ramadan, has announced that the number of medical workers killed in the Gaza Strip due to Israeli attacks has exceeded 990. Ramadan attributed the casualties to Israeli attacks on hospitals and their facilities, which have put numerous medical centers out of service. In addition, he denounced the kidnapping of more than 300 members of the medical staff. The minister's disclosure of the death toll was preceded by a strong condemnation of the atrocious acts committed by Israel in the Gaza Strip against strong defenders of humanitarian health. On the same day, Ramadan reported that 5 employees of the Ministry of Health were killed and others wounded in an attack on the entity's warehouses in Musaba, Rafah, aimed at depleting resources. The minister also noted that Israeli bombings have rendered 130 ambulances inoperative and triggered a wave of attacks that has completely destabilized the health system in the occupied West Bank.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website's working well at radiohc.cu. There's no podcast, however. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You have to look even harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can listen to past shows, find information for online donations. There's a link at my website, along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. Yet, I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury and staying in a home that's connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.